They were fun while they lasted, but our salad days with hydrocarbon fuels are rapidly coming to an end. But before we move on into the sunshine of carbohydrate fuels, there is a very interesting question that should be addressed, which is, which will come first, food or fuel?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 510th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Port Douglas who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. But whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Dave Michaels on the boards. Hello, Dave.
Good morning.
Producer Marlene Olson on the phones. Hello, Marlene.
Hi, Michael.
Folks, sooner or later, we will make the transition from hydrocarbons to carbohydrates. Simply put, this means that instead of sucking petroleum out of the Earth's crust and refining it into gasoline, we're going to grow plants on top of the Earth's crust and refine them into ethanol and diesel. But as we look into a future of carbohydrate fuels, we wonder what impact they will have on our ability to feed ourselves. In other words, which will come first, food or fuel? Here to help us find some answers, we have a cast of great characters. We're going to start with Peter Golbitz, who is the founder and CEO of Soyatech LLC. Peter, welcome to the Food Chain. Don't have Peter, but we do have in the studio David Bloom. David is the author of the forthcoming book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, right?
Yeah, good morning, Michael.
And, well, we have a couple other people that are going to join us here, but you brought up something that was really interesting to me the last time you were on the Food Chain show, and that was that as we speak, Brazil is currently manufacturing ethanol, cellulosic ethanol, for 50 cents a gallon. Is that true?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And the exciting thing about cellulosic ethanol is that it completely sidesteps this whole discussion of food versus fuel, because cellulose is basic plant fibers. So basically your lawn clippings are cellulose and branch shreddings are cellulose, or in the case of sugarcane in Brazil, the leftover fiber after crushing the sugar to get a sugarcane to get the sugar out. So we have a lot more cellulose than we have any other kind of carbohydrate.
And the interesting thing about what you said was, to me, was that, holy smokes, this is something that's happening now. This whole notion of being able to switch from hydrocarbons to carbohydrates. If Brazil is able to manufacture ethanol at 50 cents a gallon, then this is a possibility. This is something that's really happening.
Well, not only is it really happening there, but there are a whole number of initiatives in the United States that are, you know, rapidly gearing up to do similar things, although usually with more expensive processes that can be patented and, you know, and because that's the way we make money in this country, is on intellectual property. But the process in Brazil will probably end up being more cost-effective than most things that are being developed in the U.S., and it's here today. It's already happening.
Well, let's go to Peter Golbitz, who's the founder and CEO of Soyatech. Peter, do we have you now? We do not have him now. Oh, I see. He's switched to line three here. Peter, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, good. Gotcha.
Great.
Having a little phone problems today, but hey, this is radio. We can survive it. Peter, what is Soyatech?
Soyatech is an information company that produces an annual directory on the soybean and oilseed industry. We have a daily news service, and basically we track production and utilization of soybean and oilseed-related products and make sure that we also promote the value-added aspect of agriculture, which, of course, is the big movement within that currently is biofuels.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, David Bloom just suggested that that the biofuels are a very real possibility. We're manufacturing ethanol in Brazil at for 50 cents a gallon right now, so you know, the future is kind of bright. Do you see, are you similarly optimistic about biofuels?
It's an interesting question, and I think it's a very complex answer, and it's not a matter of whether we could produce fuels at a low enough cost. I think the question needs to be answered in a much more holistic sense, such as, well, first of all, on the corn and soybean side, in terms of being able to produce enough fuel to make an impact, to use soybeans and corn resources for biofuels is going to have a tremendous impact on the availability and price of food and be extremely disruptive to the ag markets as we get into the higher levels of production between 2010 and 2015. The use of cellulosic technology is perhaps one of the brighter lights on the horizon and could be used to supplement what can be produced from sugarcane and corn. But I think the real question we need to ask ourselves are, why are we still burning fuels to power automobiles and transportation when there are more sustainable and less polluting answers that is really where we should be focusing our attention long term?
Yeah, but I guess the answer would be something along the lines that somebody's making a lot of money doing it that way.
Well, certainly. Right?
Well, there's other reasons too. And Peter, you've brought up a raft of issues. Let me kind of hit a couple of them.
Let me go back first to Larry Matlack, who is another guest. So let me bring him into the fold here. Larry, are you there?
Yes.
Good. Larry's the president of the American Agriculture Movement. What is the American Agriculture Movement, Larry?
American Agriculture Movement is a farm advocacy group. Works to try and put farmers back on the land, stop the farmers from producing crops below the cost of production and continuing to leave the land.
Right. Well, we have a couple people who seem to be pretty optimistic about our ability to produce fuels from biomass. Are you similarly optimistic, Larry?
I am optimistic that there is a new day here with energy production coming from farms. You know, farmers have been told for, well, certainly all of my lifetime of 40 years of farming that we just weren't going to be able to produce enough food, and yet we have continued to excel and produce more and more, and farmers in this country are producing far below the cost of production of most of the grains. So we're sure that we can supply the ethanol industry and the biodiesel industry for many years into the future, but cellulose is the long-term answer.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we'll be able to produce food in the same environment?
Oh, absolutely.
You think there is going to be room for food and fiber?
What's that?
Do you think there is going to be room for food and fuel then?
Yes, there will be plenty of room for both, because there is agriculture has a tremendous overcapacity, especially in this country. We're like a factory operating at about 20% of production capacity currently.
Okay, good. Well, let's go back to Peter Golbitz then. Peter, you're the one who's raising the objection to the possible bright future of this relationship between producing fuel and producing food at the same time. What is objection number one here that you see on the horizon?
Well, let me clarify, too. I believe that for the next 5 to 10 years, there is a way that we can do both sides of the equation. And I think that as we look into the future, it's going to get more difficult to do that, given the rise in energy needs over the next 10 or 15 years, not only of our country, but of the rest of the world. And I think it's important to take a longer-term, more holistic look. Currently, we do have, it needs to be clarified too, just because a resource is renewable, like an agricultural resource, does not mean it's unlimited, nor does it mean it's sustainable because of the issues with weather and water supply and so on. And we do have a limited amount of acreage which can be brought into high production. And we're pretty much at that level now with corn and soybeans. And right now on the corn side, we produce 60% of the world trade of corn. And on the soybean side, we're the largest soybean producer in the world.
Okay, so you're... Your objection number one is that you think we're pretty much tapped out as we are.
I think on the corn and soybean side, I think...
Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to pick up that issue. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about food and fuel, which will be the most important in the future. Curious to know what you think. Do you think it should be food, or do you think it should be fuel? 800-624-2665, 831-4719-80. Right back with David Bloom, Peter Golbitz, Larry Matlack, and you. Do stay tuned. Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about food or fuel. You know, we're pretty much to the point in the world where we're running out of hydrocarbon fuel. I mean, the indications are all there. War, an atmosphere filled with CO2. Let's just get over it and move on. Move on to something else. Move on to biofuels, fuels that don't pollute the atmosphere to the extent that petroleum does, and fuels that won't cost us a war every time we need to fill up the gas tank. And so that's what we're talking about, the prospect of being able to grow our own fuel and enrich our heartland with a crop that is needed. And that's kind of when we look at our heartland right now, we seem to be subsidizing our farmers for essentially growing things that we really don't need all that much. Am I wrong, Larry?
Oh, that's exactly right. We are subsidizing the production of products that have been in an oversupply for many, many years and will be for many years in the future. Corn and soybeans have been below the cost of production at the market level for many years. Ethanol and biodiesel bring an opportunity to change that so that, in fact, the farmers' returns can come from the marketplace rather than from the government coffer.
David Bloom.
You know, this really ties back into the earlier comment that, you know, going after some of these crops for fuel is going to raise the price of these commodities to make our food prices higher. As Larry knows, you know, farmers are getting 5 cents a pound for corn right now, and that's just absurd. You know, we feed roughly 10 pounds of corn to make 1 pound of beef, because really, you know, really looking at corn, it's cattle food, it's not human food. 87% of our corn goes to feed animals, not humans. So if it's a human food versus fuel issue, well, that's not there, because we're not feeding corn to people.
Well, let me ask you this, and Peter Golbitz, maybe I can start with you. Is our effort to subsidize the ethanol industry in the heartland through the grain ethanol of corn, is that having an impact on the food chain already?
Well, it is, to the extent that it's changing where the corn is moving. The distribution dynamics are being strained just due to corn moving in different directions and in different areas than it was previously. The comment about that the corn goes to feed, you need to understand, although 87% of the corn goes to feed goes to animals, we're the ones eating those animals. And it's going to take about 30 to 45% of our corn crop to even supply us with just 10% of our gasoline needs. So, you know, let me ask you, where is that corn going to come from? There's going to be some increase in yields. There's going to be a little bit of increase in acreage. But that corn's going to need to come from somewhere. If it's not fed to animals, you know, if we need to understand that if that corn is produced into ethanol, it's going to take it out of what goes into the world export market, and it's going to take it out of the mouths of animals, which means there's going to be less animal production and there's going to be higher price for animal products.
Well, so, Peter, let me explain to you a little bit about this.
This is David Bloom here.
Yeah. So when we take corn and make alcohol, the only thing we're making into alcohol is the starch, which is the carbohydrate part of the corn. All the protein and fat remain in what's called dried distillers, grains, and solubles, which is a standard animal feed. It's the byproduct left over from making alcohol. Now, what you need to know about cattle is they evolved in the forest, not in the prairies. They're not evolved to eat grasses or the grains of grasses. They're good at eating cellulose. In fact, they cannot digest starch. They poop out 80% of the starch that we feed them. So when we take the starch and we make alcohol with it...
Is that where the methane comes from?
Methane is partly caused by the starch, but also just because of the general you know, stuff that goes on in the guts of cows. So if we take the alcohol first by taking the starch out, and we then feed the byproduct to the cattle, a very interesting thing occurs. You get 17% more meat if you feed the byproduct to the cattle instead of the original corn. And that's because there's a huge amount of energy that goes into not digesting that corn and it being in the way of digesting other things. Any revenuer knows this because when he goes to the county fair, he sees who has the fattest hogs and the fattest cows, and that's where he knows the still is because that's people are fermenting. So it's not an issue of food versus fuel. It's an issue of if you don't make alcohol, you starve the world, because that 17% greater production of beef would actually equal enough grain to feed everyone on the planet. So, you know, the food versus fuel thing was coined by the American Petroleum Institute in 1979. And we've been arguing this meaningless question ever since. So the increase in meat and milk production by first fermenting the corn into alcohol is a very real, very demonstrable study that's been done 100 times in the last 20 years.
Peter, you have a response?
We don't feel there's a limit on the amount of dry distiller grains that can be fed the current animals that are being fed feed corn.
The limit is the same amount of corn that we're feeding today, but I would go further than that because basically the issue isn't so much about corn. It's, you know, now we're talking about the real issue, which is, you know, it's not food versus fuel for people, it's food versus fuel for animals. Weaver just pointed out that you could, for every bit of corn that you use, you actually get an increase in meat. But let's talk about what animals can eat, which is basically any of the byproducts from the system. And if you talk about, for instance, switching to cellulose or even other crops, which I'd love to talk about because we don't have to go all the way to cellulose to supply our needs. Just the yeast alone from a national system that produced alcohol for all of our cars would be sufficient to replace all the grain we currently use in feeding cattle. So just the yeast byproduct alone from making cellulosic ethanol would replace what we need from grain now.
Roy called and really, really wants to know about the difference between cellulosic fuel and the CO2 compared with fossil fuels. So when we burn ethanol, what is the difference between CO2 levels and petroleum?
Well, it's quite dramatic, really. You see, plants breathe in CO2, they take in water, and they take in sunlight. And those three things make carbohydrates. So sunlight, water, and CO2. When we burn the alcohol, the solar energy is released as the explosion in the engine, and then the CO2 and water are returned back to the air via the exhaust pipe, which is exactly the amount of CO2 and water needed by next year's crop to make next year's alcohol. So, you know, in essence, the simple answer is that it's carbon neutral, that it actually doesn't produce any net carbon dioxide. But in reality, that's not true. Because plants make more than just the grain. There's the whole stalk, there's the root system, etc. So for every pound of corn you get that we then make into alcohol, you get 2.5 pounds of stalk, which represents an enormous amount of CO2 that's come from the atmosphere. And since nowadays we no longer burn the fields like we did 20 years ago, that carbon gets turned into the soil, which becomes food for soil microlife, which eat it and impound that carbon for a period of time. So the more carbohydrate photosynthesis we do, the more CO2 we take out of the atmosphere. And as we start increasing the amount of photosynthesis we do to make fuel, we will start reversing the greenhouse effect.
And the difference between that way of doing things and petroleum.
Well, see, the thing about petroleum is that when you burn the petroleum, you get about the same amount of CO2 as you would from alcohol from the tailpipe. But the difference is there's nothing soaking the CO2 up in the petroleum cycle. That's from plants.
So you're not growing anything. You're not growing anything green to soak up the CO2 then.
That's right, because petroleum was produced from plants that were alive millions of years ago and are not alive today. So that's the difference between using a biofuel that is currently using sunlight and using up CO2 versus a petroleum fuel.
Well, we've got to take a quick break here, but when we get back, I want to get to the big question, which is what happens when we have such a demand for these fuels that we start taking away from the productive resources in the developing world? Who's going to be able to come out on top. Our demand for the rich nations' demands for fuel, or the poor nations' demands for food. And we're going to pick up another caller from Berkeley, Dr. Let's see if I can get his name here. I'll introduce him when we get back, but we've got Dr. Robert Van Buskirk from Berkeley, who's working on this issue, too. So do stay tuned, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1980. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, do stay tuned. So, folks, the question is, which will come first, food or fuel? Those of us in the developed world have a lot of money to buy fuel, and we use a lot of it, and if it comes to pass that we have to grow our fuel in the form of carbohydrate energy, then we're going to be competing with those in the world who have to rely on farming to get their food. Let's see. I'm going to go to Peter Golbitz, who's the founder and CEO of Soyatech. Peter, you were talking earlier about the pyramid, the marketplace pyramid. Would you describe that, please, and how that has an impact on this basic equation that we're talking about?
Well, there are four fifths. If we look at the consuming consumers in the world as a pyramid, where the very top of the pyramid is where we as Americans, or the top sector of Americans with consuming power, and Europeans and so on, we're at the top of this pyramid. So it's a rather small piece. The bottom of the pyramid is much larger and represents about four fifths of the world that has incomes of below $1,500 a year. And this is the part of the world that's not only the largest, but is the fastest growing and is going to contribute even more people to our planet in the next 10 to 15 years. And in order to supply enough food and energy to those individuals as well, it is going to take a concerted effort to promote agricultural production in other parts of the world, and basically to try to balance what our needs are in the Western world with those needs of the developing world. And the reason we're in the situation we are today with gasoline consumption and even some of our chronic disease issues in the U.S. is basically due to overconsumption. And, you know, we're overconsuming fuels, we're overconsuming food. And
just take a look at us, right?
What's that?
Just take a look at us, right?
Yeah. And there is enough food. I'm not saying that we're starving the world currently. There is a surplus each year, and the reason why a lot of the world does not have adequate food resources, a lot of that's political reasons. And I think that we need to take a look at the politics of overconsumption and why we're in the position today of even having this discussion about food versus fuel. It would be nice if we took a longer-term look at how we can stimulate agricultural self-sufficiency in other parts of the world. And I think reducing farm subsidies will do that, because as we reduce farm subsidies, the price of commodities will rise. American farmers will be happier. And it also will make farming more profitable in less developed and in less productive parts of the world. And maybe we can create some more self-sufficiency. But in reality, if we were not trying to utilize a renewable source and a relatively limited source of our food for fuel, and instead looked for that energy directly either from the sun or from wind or some other renewable source and continuous source, then the discussion about how are we going to feed another 6 to 8 billion people on our planet in the next 20 years wouldn't be as much of an issue. And so biofuels to me represents a short-term solution, and I hope a long-term solution, because it raises awareness of some of the other issues relative to living in a sustainable world.
Okay, let me throw that one to Larry Matlack, president of the American Agriculture Movement. Larry, are you willing to give up your subsidies?
Well, the farm subsidies are a political issue. They generally have little effect on the price of the commodities the farmers produce. Those prices are basically determined at the Chicago Board of Trade every day. What the real issue is that this earth produces 100 times enough biomass to supply the total energy need for the earth. And farmers are a big part of that. But because fossil fuels for many years have been plentiful and inexpensive,
That's never been an issue. Today, that's changing. And agriculture is the answer.
So, Larry, let me ask you a question. This is Dave again. If, you know, and I'd like to let you know that I was a farmer for 10 years in California, so, you know, I have a little bit of understanding. If you went to your farmers and said, hey, I'll tell you what, instead of growing corn, especially you guys, say, out in the West where there's not as much water, or you guys in the North where it's cold, what if we said we'd like you to grow something a little different, like, say, maybe sorghum in the guys north, or maybe something completely oddball like, you know, more mesquite trees or buffalo gourds in the Southwest, with the proviso that those provide more animal feed than corn and more alcohol than corn. Would your farmers consider that?
Absolutely. Farmers in this country have always, and for that matter probably worldwide, have risen to the challenge whenever there was a market for a product, whenever there was an opportunity for a profit, those farmers produced that product.
Okay, well...
You go back not so many years ago, soybeans didn't exist as a crop.
That's right, Larry. I remember it only took 5 years, you know, shortly... I guess it was after World War II where we switched to corn and soybeans versus corn, and more corn. But here's my tossing that back out. Given that, you know, your farmers would be happy to grow different crops, we have 1.5 billion acres of ag-rated land in the United States. That's half a billion acres of prime cropland and a billion acres of farmland. We only grow corn on 70 million acres, or only 7% of the total of our farmland. To put that in perspective, we grow 30 million acres of lawn in the United States, or almost half as much land as we use for corn. And that lawn itself, those lawn clippings, would produce about half as much alcohol as corn would produce. So we're only using 7% of our ag land to grow corn, and yet all the pundits that say we can't grow enough fuel only look at corn production as the source of fuel. And as you pointed out, your farmers would be willing to grow different crops. For instance, mesquite in the Southwest already occupies 70 million acres, or as much as corn, and it can produce just as much alcohol as corn with no inputs, no water, no fertilizer, no nothing, just harvest the pods that are full of sugar. So if your farmers are willing to produce it, and we've got the land, we obviously could produce not only all of our fuel, but we could actually supply a good part of the world with animal feed and fuel as well.
Larry, I'm going to put you on hold here for just a minute so I can pick up Robert Van Buskirk. Robert, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Good. You're working on this problem with of finding crops that will grow on land that is not agricultural land, correct?
Exactly. I agree with the farm folks that it would be good to take the money we're spending on the petroleum industry and spend it on our farmers. But I think... we can't ignore the fact that there is going to be a competition for resources between food production and fuel production.
So you agree with Peter then? With Peter, you're agreeing with Peter Golbitz then? That
yes, and the federal government has done some estimates of what this competition will do to food prices.
So okay, but you're gonna have to hold that until we get back. Can you do that?
Okay.
Thank you very much. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about the relationship of food and fuel. We can grow our food and we can grow our fuel. Can we grow both of them together and to survive and prosper in this world? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We have David Bloom, who's the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. We have Peter Golbitz, founder and CEO of Soytech. And we have Larry Matlack, president of the American Agricultural Movement. And also with us, we have Robert Van Buskirk, who is a researcher up at Berkeley, I believe. And you do stay tuned right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
So the question is, will we have enough resources to grow our food and to grow our fuel? That's the question of the day. What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Let's go back to Robert Van Buskirk. Robert, you were talking about the government having come up with some studies on this issue. What did they say?
Yeah, well, the USDA did an estimate of what would happen if we got an extra 150 million gallons per year of biodiesel from soybean oil. And their estimates indicate that there would be resulting 10 to 20% price increase in soybean oil, which may be a good thing. The problem is, though, that 150 million gallons of soybean oil is the amount of diesel that we use in one day. So therefore, for this particular biodiesel case, it's fairly clear that we can't rely on something as simple as just using soybean oil for biodiesel as the solution for replacing it with biofuels. And there's another statistic that I think I would like to use to illustrate
the
issues on international competition for food resources.
Mm-hmm.
The average Ethiopian spends $50 per year per person on food. The average person in the U.S. spends almost $1,400 per year per person on gasoline. The daily caloric consumption of the Ethiopian on food is 1,600 calories per day. The daily caloric equivalent of the gasoline that's burnt in the gas tank is 40,000 calories per day. So if when we convert to biofuels, we're allowing a direct competition between Americans who are filling their gas tanks and people in Africa or Asia or poor parts of the country who are trying to fill their stomachs, economically speaking, the people in the developing countries will completely lose out in the competition.
Okay.
And I think that is a moral sort of mandate on us to be very careful when we're developing our biofuel supplies.
And that was a point that Peter Gilchrist Goldblitz was making as well. David, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, sure. I totally agree that we should be conservative in our use of energy because, you know, it's only right and proper. But comparing human calories to heat calories and fuel is an irrelevant comparison. Basically, what we're talking about with biofuels is harvesting solar energy, of which on land mass alone, we get 500 million times the energy that we need to power the Earth. Now, of course, our conversion is very low percentage. But I would argue, for instance, the American Gas Association did a great study here in California that showed that we could get 24 quads of energy by growing kelp off our coast and turning it into energy. That's a third more than the total amount of fuel we use for transportation. That's just off of California. So if we did kelp farms off California, like they do in China right now, we could produce all of our transportation fuel and the kelp solution that would be left over after fermentation. We can now use those useless oil pipelines, since we've just replaced all the fuel with alcohol, and pump those nutrients back out in the Midwest to regenerate farmland. So the whole question of can we produce enough without hurting farmland, we can do it without planting one seed in the soil, and it's already been proven. You know, in the 40s in Norway, they made an enormous amount of alcohol just from kelp. The dead zone in the Mississippi from all the sewage and nitrate fertilizer that basically decimates 20,000 square miles of the Gulf could all be used to grow fuel, and that alone would produce half the energy we need. And these things are not technologically beyond us or capital-wise beyond us. To replace to create the production potential for 200 billion gallons of year of fuel, which is what we use, costs about $1 per gallon of annual production. So a couple hundred billion dollars. Wow, that sounds like a big number, but we've already spent $300 billion in Iraq. So the whole argument is almost irrelevant, because the amount of fuel we can produce based on solar energy, those calories, not calories from oil, is enormous, and the capital to do it is minor compared to what we're spending just to try to get oil out of the Middle East at, you know, a tremendous moral loss of life. And I'd say that trumps, you know, the issue of whether or not, you know, we're talking about the export potential for food from this country. You got to realize that no country in Africa today will buy American grain for human food consumption, period, because 60% of it is GMO. The only four countries in the world that will take our corn are Canada, China, Argentina, and us. So no one else in the world even wants our corn, you know, because basically it's not considered fit for human consumption.
Larry Matlack, as a representative of the agriculture, do you see agriculture benefiting in a competition for resources between food and fuel? Do you see our farmers coming out on top on this in this competition?
I see that any time that the demand for new products comes to the marketplace and you bring new buyers to the marketplace, that farmers will benefit. That's one of the largest reasons that farming has been so poor and driven so many people from the land over the past 30 years is that we have few buyers and we have many producers. The energy production all of a sudden changes that equation. And I think that's why there's so much talk about it and perhaps so much opposition in some areas, is because they would prefer that there's very few.
Oops. Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll ask the question, should fuel be first, or should food be first? And what do you think? Be right back. Do stay tuned. Well, folks, we here in the United States are spending about $500,000 a minute buying oil from foreign countries. Obviously, we're going broke buying oil from foreign nations. Wouldn't it be something if we could grow our own fuel and fuel our economy with the help of our farmers? So the question we're going to try to answer in the last few minutes of this program is, can we do both? And I'm going to start with in the studio here with David Bloom. David, can we grow fuel and can we grow food at the same time?
I think Larry was absolutely right when he points out that plants produce, you know, many, many times the amount of energy that we need. And the American farmer can produce more than enough fuel and food for everyone. And in my book, I point out 25 different crops that are all suited to different parts of the climate of the United States that are, some of them are quite surprising compared to corn, but all of them produce more than corn and lots of animal feed in the process.
Okay, let's go to Peter Golbets, founder and CEO of Soyatech. Peter, can we grow food and can we grow fuel at the same time? Are we going to be able to do it? Are you there? Maybe we lost him, so I'll just let him go. And let's go to Larry Matlack. Larry, are you there?
Hello.
Yes, Larry, gotcha. What do you think, Larry, American agriculture movement, can we grow fuel and can we grow food at the same time here in the United States? Are we going to be able to do both? Are you there?
Peter Golbets is here.
Oh, okay, Peter.
Yes.
I lost Larry then. Go ahead.
All right. Well, I think we need to keep our assumptions somewhat realistic. I believe we can, but I also believe it's going to require on the part of, certainly in the Western world that consumes so much of the energy, drastic conservation efforts on our part.
Whoops. And then I guess we lost him, by golly, but he said maybe, huh?
He said yes, but we should conserve, and he's totally right about that.
Totally right about that. Let's go to Robert Van Buskirk. Robert, what do you think? Can we do both?
I think we can do both, but it will take an effort. And there are other crops that can help diminish the competition for land and water resources. Like one crop that we plan on pilot testing with some organic farmers in Greater California is pickleweed or salicornia. It's a It's a native marsh plant. You can irrigate it with salt water, so you don't have to be, it doesn't require any irrigation resources. Produces as much biomass per acre as alfalfa, and it produces two tons per hectare per year of oil seeds. So I think when you start getting creative, when you start sort of considering the competition between food agriculture and energy agriculture, and you start looking for solutions that minimize that competition and maybe even, you know, feed back resources back to the environment, solutions will be found.
Okay, good. And Larry Matlack, you're back, American Agriculture Movement. Can we do both? Can we grow food and can we grow fiber at the same time?
Michael, I think one of the things we really need to understand is that without energy security, America's farmers can't produce even the food that we need. So energy security is the key, and agriculture can give us that.
And so you think we can?
Absolutely.
Okay. Boy, we've got a bucket full of calls and a thimble full of minutes, but we're out of time. But I want to say thank you to all who participated in today's program: David Bloom, author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas; Peter Golbitz, founder and CEO of Soyatech; Larry Matlack, president of the American Agriculture Movement; and Robert Van Buskirk, a researcher up in Berkeley. And you, do thank you so much for joining us. You can always participate in the discussion by logging on your comments at metroforum.com on the forum page there. See you next week. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.